America at a Crossroads is a weekly live webinar series that brings together journalists, scholars, thought leaders, and policymakers for discussions regarding the state of American democracy, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. The series was jointly founded by Jews United for Democracy and Justice and Community Advocates, Inc. To register for our live webinars, join our email list at JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org.
Now I'd like to introduce our guest tonight more in greater detail. Barbara McQuaid served as a United States attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She resigned in March 2017 as part of the former president's dismissal of 46 U.S. attorneys. Currently, Barbara is a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School and is a legal analyst for NBC News and for MSNBC. So if you're like me, you see Barbara quite a bit on the news. She has recently released an important book, and I showed you that book, Attack from Within, How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. The book, which I highly recommend again, discusses the ways disinformation has become a tool to drive voters to extremes, to disempower our legal structures, and to consolidate power in the hands of the few. Thank you so much for being with us, Barbara. Henry Weinstein, who has appeared many times on America at a Crossroads, is a professor of media law at UC Irvine School of Law. Henry has a long and distinguished career as a legal reporter, having served in that capacity for the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the San Francisco Examiner, and the Wall Street Journal. So you can see we have two outstanding guests tonight. Thank you both for being with us and for sharing your intelligence and your analysis with our audience. We are most appreciative. Henry, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Janice. Pleased to be here. Good evening, Barbara. Thank you for joining us to discuss your book, which I consider a must in this particular historical moment. And I have to say, after listening to your incisive legal commentary for several years on television, it's been an honor to share a Zoom screen with you. When I first learned that you had written a book on this subject, I thought about another great Michigan jurist, another great Michigan lawyer, Damon Keith, from your home state. Your book is about how disinformation can destroy democracy. And years ago, he issued a court decision overruling secret deportation hearings. And at that time, he said, democracy dies behind closed doors, a version of which was later adopted by the Washington Post on its front page logo. Just in summary, I just want to tell the audience that in 300 pages and 1,700 footnotes, Barbara, through reliable data, crisp analysis, and human stories, reminds readers that what happened on January the 6th is not behind us, that another may be looming, and that the problem grows frequently. So to start, Barbara, tell us why you decided to write Attack from Within, and what's a primary theme of the book?
Yeah, thank you, Henry. Well, first, thank you so much for welcoming me here. Thank you to Janice and Mel and Zev for having me. What a wonderful opportunity. And thanks to everybody who's tuned in tonight on the Zoom. Really an overwhelming number of people. I'm glad I can't see you because I'd be very nervous if I could. But Henry, to answer your question about why I wrote the book and about, you know, what prompted me to write it. You know, my background is primarily as a national security prosecutor. Before I was the U.S. attorney in Detroit, I spent most of my career as a national security prosecutor. And I now teach a course in national security law at the University of Michigan Law School. And one of the things that I include in my teaching is disinformation. I've been teaching about disinformation since about 2018. I have my students read the Mueller report. And, you know, not for what he did or did not find regarding Donald Trump's presidential campaign in 2016, but about what he found about Russia. And so I've had an interest in this area since 2018. I've read everything I can get my hands on. And it seemed to me that in recent years, the threat is coming less so from, I mean, still coming from other countries, but the most danger that I see us facing right now of disinformation is actually coming from within, which is where the name from the book comes from, Attack from Within. I'm seeing, you know, people in our own country using disinformation to advance their own political agenda, personal agenda, career agenda, profit agenda, whatever it may be. And, you know, although there are plenty of people who fall for these lies, they see them on social media or they hear them from others, there are plenty of other people who are just going along with the con to advance that agenda. And that is the part that I find so insidious and so deeply unpatriotic. And I thought that by writing this book and sharing what I've been able to observe, I want to make it accessible to an ordinary audience, because I really want to prompt a national conversation about the importance of truth. And I'm hopeful that if I can describe some of these tactics and reveal them and help people identify them, then together we can defeat them.
Great. This is a very large problem, but you made an interesting decision in how you started the book, talking about a woman by the name of Roseanne Boylan, who drove 10 hours to Washington, D.C. on January the 5th, so that she could, because she had, as you said, come under the spell of election deniers. And unfortunately, yesterday, not on that day, January 6th, when she entered the Capitol, she wound up being trampled to death. What was your reason for starting the book that way?
Well, I thought she was kind of a metaphor for all of us. You know, she was an innocent person, an American, someone who cared about her country. She thought she was seeing something that was wrong. And so she wanted to go to the Capitol to help with this protest and maybe, you know, got caught up in the excitement of it all. And, you know, she found herself in this, tunnel near the speaker's entrance at the Capitol. And, ultimately was killed. There's some debate about her cause of death, whether it was a drug overdose or she was trampled. But everybody agrees that she had some sort of medical emergency, and emergency responders were unable to get to her in the crush of the crowd. And what her sister said was she would not have been there at all if not for all of the disinformation. And so I thought that she was a very sad story, a very tragic story, and a cautionary tale for all of us, that she could become a metaphor for all of us if we all fall for the story, and that this disinformation is used as a weapon against us. The question is, will we allow ourselves to become like Roseanne Boylan, or will we seize our own power and rise up to defeat this threat of disinformation?
Thank you. Before we go much further, I think it would be useful for you to explain the difference between disinformation and misinformation.
Yes, great question. You know, I think a lot of people use the terms interchangeably, and there's no, you know, right or wrong about that. But I actually separate them out and define them differently in the book, because I think it's useful to think about them in those two different ways, because one is very sinister, the other is more innocent, but can amplify the former. So disinformation first is, as I define it, the deliberate use of lies, deceptions, misleading terms to deliberately deceive people, to manipulate them. Misinformation is kind of its unwitting cousin. And so when we hear false claims and we believe them, we may repeat those claims to other people, thereby spreading and amplifying this disinformation. I'll give you an example of a time I was a spreader of misinformation, Henry. I'm not proud of it, but I was unwitting. It was an innocent mistake. But it really does illustrate, I think, how it works. I read on social media that Patrick Mahomes, the NFL football star, you know, I'm a big sports fan, had announced that he would not play another down for the Kansas City Chiefs until they changed their name to something that was not offensive to Native Americans. I read that. I thought, wow, that's a big story. And I immediately retweeted it. And then later that day, I was talking to my husband and my son about it. And they said, I haven't seen that. Are you sure that's real? And I said, of course it is. What do you mean you haven't seen it? It's a big story. So I went back and I looked at my social media feed, and I discovered that although it was on Twitter, it was an account that purported to be ESPN. That's pretty good. That's pretty credible. But when I looked a little more closely, I saw that the account itself was actually called Sprotts Center, not Sports Center, but Sprotts Center, Sprotts. And I realized then that I had been duped. I had fallen for it. So I removed it right away. But it's a good example of how this works. You know, that one's fairly innocuous, I suppose. You you see something that gets you excited in some way or agitated in some way. And so you want to share that news with other people quickly, without taking the time to verify the facts and the accuracy or look for a second source. And so that is misinformation, the way we all can be conduits of false claims without even knowing it.
And speaking of the Kansas City Chiefs, the story about Mahomes turned out to be just about as true as Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce getting married at midfield and endorsing him. Right. So a lot of stuff going around at the time of the Super Bowl. Could you give a few more examples of what you can of disinformation? I think that would help people to get a firmer.
Yeah. So lots of things and lots of different techniques. So, for example, I would consider it disinformation when Donald Trump refers to people who participated in the January 6th attack and are in jail because they have been either arrested on an indictment and are awaiting trial, or they've been convicted of a crime, and he refers to them as hostages. Is it a lie? I don't know. It's a characterization, but it suggests that they are somehow political prisoners instead of criminal defendants, as they are. So that's one example. I think that some of the things we're seeing coming out of Russia right now in kind of pro-Russian, anti-Ukrainian information, disinformation is an example of disinformation. Things like saying that Vladimir Zelensky's inner circle is losing faith in him and wants to give up on him. Yeah. You know, those are designed to sort of cause morale to suffer. I know in the early days after October 7th, we saw reports that there were rockets that were coming from Israel destroying a hospital in Gaza. And in fact, that turned out to be false, but was being spread on social media, I think, to cause people to think ill of Israel at that time, shortly after October 7th. So it can take on a lot of forms. I think you know, some of the things we're seeing now are efforts to interfere in the 2024 election with robocalls and other kinds of things, artificial intelligence generated things, accounts on social media that appear to be run by someone they're not. So there are a lot of different techniques of disinformation, but there are all these, you know, some are lies, some are propaganda, some are things designed to push our buttons. Even, you know, these efforts by some members of the Republican Party to own the libs by referring, if you ever heard this one, Henry, they refer to Democrats as members of the Democrat Party instead of the Democratic Party.
All the time.
I mean, even that is, it's an effort to pick a fight, to get people agitated, to get people mad, to divide and conquer. And so all of those things are different flavors of disinformation.
As to your first example, I just wanted to say that I found it noteworthy within the past few weeks that at least one federal judge has become very upset about this. When he sentenced a man who had committed a number of violations on January 6th, U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth in Washington, D.C., who was an appointee of Ronald Reagan in 1987, said the following in the sentencing. The January 6th riot was not an act of civil disobedience because it was violent, not peaceful, opportunistic, not principled, coercive, not persuasive, and selfish, not patriotic. That's a strong statement for a federal judge who doesn't normally opine on such matters. Looking at something more broadly, it seems like disinformation can have either granular goals, such as cigarettes are safe for human beings, there's no such thing as climate change, Trump won the election in a landslide. And then perhaps there's a bigger goal of denialism, which I'd like you to talk about, distrust, sowing distrust.
Yes. So, you know, one of the things that the Mueller report diagnoses is the Russian disinformation campaign to sow discord in society, to get Americans angry with each other so that we are polarized and we are focused on cultural issues instead of issues that might make life more difficult for Russia. So if we're all mad at each other and we're arguing about things within our own society, then we're less interested in what's going on in Ukraine and with NATO and with Europe. And so one of the things they targeted is picking every fault line there is in society, whether it is a debate over guns, debate over the LGBTQ community, debate over immigration, abortion, you know, whatever is the biggest hot button issues. And then to say things on social media purporting to be an advocate for one side or the other, but saying awful, despicable things designed to make opponents of that viewpoint think, look at these people. They're outrageous. I can't believe anything they say. They're horrible. I'll give you an example. Just the other day, I saw something online that I am sure is one of these things planted by somebody in just in an effort to stoke division in society. It was a picture of a teenage white girl and a teenage black boy dressed for the prom. And alongside it, it purported to be the text message exchange between the high school girl and her white father. And it was the most ugly, racist rant you can ever imagine. Oh, look, everybody, here's what my dad said after my prom. I brought home my prom date. Now, what girl's really going to post this on social media, right? This is what all the ugly stuff my dad said to me. But it's as ugly as you can imagine. How dare you bring home that such and such? You're dead to me. I'm canceling your phone, all this stuff. And then predictably, you've got all kinds of other people howling about how awful this is. I think it's all made up. I think it's all just an effort to stoke divisions in society and for people to believe, you know, and reinforce ideas about racism. You know, if you wonder why it feels so polarized today, it's because Russia's been working hard at this since about 2015, and they're pretty good at it. And it seems to be working. I think, though, the attack from within that I talk about in the book is an effort to destabilize society, to undermine our institutions. So if we can attack the press as the enemy of the people, if we can attack courts and persuade people that they're all corrupt, that courts are on the take, that the courts presiding over the Donald Trump cases are engaging in election interference, if we can persuade people that the police are a disgrace, that they should be defunded, then that is part of the narrative. If we can tell people that the border is a sieve and immigrants are coming across and they're all, you know, animals and vermin and poisoning the blood of society, you know, these all resonate with people who share certain values of, you know, Christian nationalism or ideas of America as a white superior country. And so I think it is an effort by some members of the far right who see themselves losing a battle for the hearts and minds of the country, resorting to tricks to exploit people's fears and prejudices to hold on to power.
Hey, thank you. One of the, I want to go back to what you said about hearts and minds with a little prelude. One of the scholars who has praised your book lavishly is Timothy Snyder, who wrote a terrific book about 20 lessons on tyranny. Mm-hmm. And one of the things most important that he emphasized was the critical importance of believing in truth. And he said to abandon facts is to abandon freedom. If nothing is true, then no one can criticize power because there's no basis on which to do so, unquote. Now, at first blush, that sounds like a pretty obvious, simple proposition. But you have a chapter of your book appropriately titled, Hearts Are Bigger Than Minds, Why Disinformation Works. And in that chapter, you dive into perhaps, I think, one of the most challenging aspects of the problem you're discussing, and that's exploring why millions of Americans now live in a fact-free universe. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, this idea that I'm going to appeal to emotion over logic is something that really helps disinformation work. And I think one of the reasons we find ourselves in at this point in this moment is because of the information overload that we all feel. There's so much information out there that it's difficult to sort what is true from what is false. And so instead, we have people relying more on a feeling. And, you know, there are certain politicians who exploit that. I know that I can exploit fear as a feeling. I can exploit conspiracy theories. I can exploit stubbornness. And those are the kinds of things that are really appealing to our hearts instead of our minds. And I think it is something that is why we are seeing somebody like, you know, Donald Trump so successful. I think for many people, it's absolutely astonishing that this man could in any possible way be elected president, because he is, some might say, a despicable human being, some might say. I think that is people thinking with, you know, their heads and thinking logically and applying argument. But there's a huge swath of the American public, I think, who find themselves overwhelmed with information. And so they make decisions more from their gut and from feelings. And if you look at some of the things that we've seen here are some of the tricks that authoritarians have used throughout history are some of the same tricks we see Donald Trump use today. So, you know, one of them is this idea of declinism, that our country is going downhill. It's never been worse. We are a country in ruins. Hitler wrote about this in Mein Kampf and talked about, you know, his whole strategy for how he would take power. And talked about, you know, he was someone who ranted about declinism, the shame of the German people following World War I, and how, you know, the economy was terrible and, things were awful in their country. You know, now we hear Trump talk about American carnage, cities in ruins. In fact, if you look at the facts as opposed to this mood, you know, unemployment is way down, jobs are way up. Crime is down. Wages are up. Certainly inflation is up, but that's what happens in a thriving economy. Prices go up when all these other indicators are going up. GDP is up. And so instead, there's a real feeling, though, that things are getting bad, because we talk about how bad it is all the time. And he talks about how bad it is all the time. So this idea of declinism, because when you're in declinism, that creates some opportunities, right? First, you have to blame somebody. And so you can find other people to blame. For Hitler, of course, it was Jewish people. For Donald Trump, it's immigrants. Immigrants are animals. They're vermin. They're poisoning the blood of our society. And so they're taking your jobs. Or people of color. Some will raise the LGBTQ community. Trump, not so much, but DeSantis and other members of the far right will talk about how the LGBTQ community wants to groom our children for pedophilia, right? There's always some demon out there that we can blame for all our woes. Because things are so desperate times, of course, call for desperate measures. Hitler said, we need to suspend the Constitution to achieve our ends. Donald Trump himself has said that when an election is stolen, we need to resort to drastic measures, including terminating the Constitution. People feel that our country is in such bad shape that maybe we should have a strong leader. You know, Donald Trump jokes about being a dictator for a day and kind of tosses out there and normalizes it. And people say, I wouldn't mind. I hope he is a dictator, because he'll fix it. Because our country is so broken that we need someone who is strong and bold, and only he can fix it. So it really fits this whole mold of how authoritarians have manipulated people through fear and demonization for decades, if not centuries.
So there have been big lies for many years. You have a great chapter which starts with a quote from Jonathan Swift saying, falsehood flies and the truth comes limping after it. Problem seems to have magnified quite a bit, though, because of the internet, right?
Yeah. So as we said, many of these techniques and these tactics are age old. But the thing that is really fueled the disinformation of the moment is the internet, and in particular, social media. One of the things that is described in the Mueller report in great detail is the way the Internet Research Agency in Russia was able to use false personas online to not only stoke division, but influence the 2016 election. And so they were able to, you know, like all of us, we can reach millions of people in an instant. We've got, you know, what, over 2,000 people joining this conversation tonight, right? We're all together. Yet I heard that people are in North Carolina and there are people in California and there are people in New York and Michigan, all over the place. We can reach so many people. We can reach them instantly and we can reach them anonymously. And so in the Mueller report, he talks about how Russia, you know, Russian operatives working out of this internet research agency created false personas online with names that made them appear to be ordinary Americans who were political activists. So there was one called Blacktivist, who appeared to be an African-American activist in the United States. He posted frequently. He said all kinds of interesting things and attracted many thousands of followers. There was another called United Muslims of America. There was one called Tennessee GOP. There was one called Heart of Texas. So for whatever group is out there, there is a an affinity group that looks like a nice Facebook group that you ought to join. They also had groups on Twitter and YouTube and other places. And so people joined. And then as the election approached, started saying things like Blacktivist posted, "Hillary Clinton has never done anything for our community," Blacktivist told his hundreds of thousands of followers. So we should send her a message and stay home on election day and let her know that our community will not be taken for granted. You know, you'll never know how many African-American followers of Blacktivist saw that message and believed it to be, you know, good advice from this Black political activist. But if even only a few people in a swing state with a thin margin of victory did heed that call, it could have made a difference in the outcome of the election. So the internet is an incredibly powerful tool, an incredibly powerful vehicle for spreading disinformation, which is why I think we are at this crisis moment right now.
So do you think that there should be a more organized effort by truth tellers to start doing more of this? I mean, liars aren't the only people who can use the internet. And yeah, one of the primary goals seems to be to repeat, repeat, repeat until a message sinks in. And there doesn't seem to be enough truth being repeated and sinking in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, certainly, I mean, debunking things that are false, but one of the challenges, Henry, is that, you know, when people are in the business of promoting disinformation online, it's their job. They're pumping out hundreds of messages an hour. And the other thing they do is they have bots, which are AI generated accounts. They're not real people. Right. They're software also designed to look like a real account. And right, they are liking and sharing all of those false claims. And so they are multiplying those claims exponentially. And so it's really difficult for an ordinary person in real time to debunk these claims. People do it. I do it sometimes and say, that's false. Here are the facts. But I think that we need to explore some of these corrective measures so that we can debunk some of these things. I think it can be done. The internet is still in its infancy. Social media is, only what, 10 or 20 years old or so. In 1996, when the Communications Decency Act was passed, Section 230 gave social media immunity from legal liability. And the reason was that we wanted to foster innovation and free these companies from worrying about legal liability. But that was then, and this is now, and now we've seen ways that it can be abused. And maybe it's time to reconsider how we think about regulating social media so that maybe we can rein in some of these opportunities for disinformation.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I mean, so far, the Supreme Court, when faced with this, seems to want to punt, unfortunately. A lot of people think there's problems with Section 230, but nobody seems to have figured out a solution. So you've been talking about a lot of problems. Why don't you tell us about some of the possible solutions to this problem that you see?
Yes. So I'll start there with regulating social media. I think that is one of the things we can do, but only one. And that really is an effort to kind of slow down disinformation from the supply side. And I think there are a number of things we can do. that would not run afoul of the First Amendment by regulating content. So one of those things would be to regulate the algorithms that are used. You know, algorithms are just computer code that tell the platform which content should rise to the top of your feed. And we know from a whistleblower for Facebook named Francis Haugen that Facebook was using algorithms that were designed to generate outrage. And if there was something that we didn't like and we were, it keeps us online longer. And so they thought it was more profitable for us to be outraged when we're online because that made us stay on longer. We had more engagement with the platform, which meant they could charge advertisers more money because they had more eyeballs on the platform for longer periods of time. But what she said is it was causing people to, you know, spend time and when they opened their platform, instead of seeing, you know, the birthday party that your friends were at, now you're starting to see all of this content that is designed to agitate us and make you mad. Look at these dopes. Look at these idiots. Look at these bad people. Look at these, you know, whatever they are. And so, you know, we're exchanging things. And so that is part of what is so divisive about society. Some of it is, you know, the thing I just told you about, like the high school girl with her prom date, you know, that's the kind of thing that gets pushed to the top of people's media feeds, and it's false and it's designed solely to cause us to fight with each other. And so instead, why couldn't we regulate the algorithms? You know, we won't tell them what content they can have online, but we can tell them you can't deliberately design software and computer programs to agitate us, or at the very least, you have to disclose what your algorithms do. And that could be a law that could have civil penalties for a failure to comply. I think another thing that we could do is we could prevent social media companies from scraping our private data and then selling it to advertisers and to political consultants. You know, I have four children. I tell my kids that, you know, if you don't know what the product is, the product is you. And that's the case when it comes to social media. You know, it's free. Well, sure, it's free because they're acquiring something very valuable from you in exchange. And that is all of your personal information. There is no, it's no surprise, Henry, that I receive all kinds of ads and posts when I go on social media pertaining to the Detroit Tigers. I'm a big fan and I'm of a certain age. So I get all kinds of things saying, remember how great it was when the Tigers won it all in 1984? Yes, yes, I do. And I want to read all about it. They know me better than I know myself. Lately, I've been getting a lot of ads to buy a Detroit Tigers baseball cap. It's that time of year. You know, why couldn't we prohibit them from scraping our data and using our data and monetizing it in ways that are not profitable to us? Or, you know, an opt-in option. If you want those targeted ads, good for you. But instead of you know, being a condition to being on the platform, instead making it something that you have an opportunity to decline if you want to. I think that's something we do. And finally, when it comes to social media, I think we could eliminate bots. I think we could prohibit them and not allow them to operate online. These are, you know, cluttering up social media. They are getting into arguments with people because they're programmed to. If they detect certain words on your feed, they will start calling you every name in the book. I have been occasionally in recent weeks since my book came out, attacked by armies of people accusing me of censorship because I've been speaking about disinformation and truth and other kinds of things. And I am sure many of those are bots that are just designed to, you know, go after me and programmed to say mean things. So I choose not to argue with them. But why couldn't we just eliminate them from social
media? You think that's logistically feasible?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Because every once in a while, you'll notice that Twitter goes in and actually cleans up the bots. You'll see people say, I just lost 5,000 followers. What happened? And I think it's because they went in and cleaned up some of the bot accounts that might have been following you. And your bots are liking and sharing a lot of the disinformation in an effort to amplify it. So if we got rid of those, I think that could be helpful. I also think this one might run afoul of the First Amendment because it might be a little more controversial, but it would be to require verified users and no anonymous accounts online. So you couldn't be Blacktivist or United Muslims of America. You'd have to use your real name if you want to be online. I think that one might be a little more controversial.
Well, that would be a dramatic difference, and that also potentially could lead to libel suits.
Yes, which would be a good thing, right? It would be a deterrent from saying, you know, awful, false things. I think the counter argument to that is that anonymous speech has long been protected by the First Amendment because it is what allows us to speak truth to power. You know, Publius can write their notes and without worrying about repercussions. But it's an idea. I also think, Henry, there are things we can do, you know, more from the demand side, that's sort of the supply side. I think we could improve the media literacy in this country. We could teach our kids media literacy. In Finland, they started doing that in recent years because they have had so much problems, so many problems with disinformation from Russia, who is their neighbor, that they have introduced into schools media literacy with great success. You know, teaching people that when you read a news report, make sure the source is legitimate and it's not Sprott Center. It's actually Sports Center and not Sprott Center. Right. Don't just read the headline. Sometimes the headline is very misleading and does not reflect what's actually in the story. Look for a second source before you get excited and share big news about Patrick Mahomes. You should understand the difference between causation and correlation. If there is a statistical study of some sort, make sure the sample size is large enough. You know, was it 20,000 people or 20? That might make a difference in whether that was a legitimate sample size. So those are some things we can do. I also think, Henry, we need to restore civics education in this country. I have read that we spend 5 cents on civics education in our public schools for every $50 we spend on STEM education. Now, STEM education is important. STEM education is probably more expensive because of all the equipment it requires. But 5 cents, come on, we can do better than that. And I think that if we had better civics education, and when I was in high school, we had to take a civics course, people would have a very basic, at least, understanding of checks and balances in our system of government and the three branches and other things that are designed to safeguard society and the institutions we rely on to advance our society. And, you know, the concept of civic virtue as opposed to everyone for themselves and, you know, maximizing our own self-interest. I think that would be a really important thing to helping to address some of the problems we're seeing today.
As distinct from people who serve in the military or suckers.
Yes.
Certainly heard.
Precisely.
Now, let me ask you something. There are two things that happened in the past year that's are sort of seem to me a positive development, maybe on a small level. But what do you think about the significance of Fox having to pay $787 million because of the lies that they told about Dominion voting system? And what about perhaps the cruelest social media person going, Alex Jones?
Mm-hmm. There have been some very good developments in the defamation arena in recent years that actually does give me a lot of hope that this can be a useful tool. It won't address all disinformation because, as you said, when people are anonymous online, there's really no one to sue. But, you know, when Fox News gave oxygen to that theory that Dominion voting systems had flipped votes from Donald Trump to Joe Biden, you know, there are lots of people. I have a lot of friends who say my parents sit around watching Fox News every night. You know, people hear that over and over again, and they believe it to be true. Of course, as was revealed in that lawsuit, it was Fox News that actually was the first to call accurately that Arizona had gone for Joe Biden. But when they did, many of their viewers got angry with them and turned them off and started, you know, watching that News Nation or Bright
America
or some of these other things because they were very angry that they reported this information. And so to lure those viewers back, they started airing all of these claims about Dominion voting systems, you know, really bizarre, completely made up claims. And so, you know, Dominion, to their credit, didn't let it go, filed a lawsuit, and ultimately accepted a settlement of $700 million. I know some people like me were frustrated that they didn't go to trial because I wanted to see all the evidence come out. And I think we were perhaps denied some of that evidence as a result. But $700 million is a great, you would think, great disincentive. Although I did see just in the next week, Henry, was when Fox News fired Tucker Carlson, which I don't know, you know, they never said publicly that one was related to the other, but you know, it's hard to not draw that conclusion. So that gave me a lot of hope. You know, he was one of the greatest purveyors of some of these theories. But then just a few weeks later, I saw a headline or a graphic down at the bottom of the screen on Fox News that was the screen was depicting Joe Biden. And it said something like, wannabe dictator indicting his political rival. So there they, you know, there they go again. But you mentioned Alex Jones. You know, he has been found liable by parents, sets of parents in Texas and Connecticut, to the tune of more like $1.4 billion or something like that. And of course, he had one of the cruelest stories of defamation ever, which is that the Sandy Hook shooting at the elementary school, you know, with the first graders, was a false flag operation staged by the U.S. government in an effort to take away our guns. That, you know, the idea was we're going to stage this horrific attack, made up, never happened. But the idea of it is people will be so horrified that they will willingly surrender gun rights in response. Because people heard Alex Jones talk about that, you know, he's got this InfoWars website and podcast. Because people heard that, they began calling the parents, you know, parents who spoke out and said, I lost my baby. And, you know, this day, it's awful. Here's his picture. Here's what happened. People, they were harassed. They would get personally harassed in public. They would get phone calls, mail, all kinds of things, calling them, you know, liars and treasonous traitors to our country for going along with this scam. I mean, imagine the horror, really it's unimaginable, of losing your first grader to an active shooter when you sent your child to school. And then to add insult to injury, you've got this joker who is saying all kinds of made up stuff to make a profit. Alex Jones in his best year made $64 million in profit on his podcast and his whole network of shows because he gets advertising from all of these like survivalist companies. You know, they'll sell you a bulletproof vest and rations for your bunker and all this kind of stuff. So he was making big money off of these crazy conspiracy theories, but he was hurting real people. So that gave me hope, a lot of money there. And just today, I think it was, Henry, I read that the judge upheld the verdict against Rudy Giuliani in the defamation case against Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss about, you know, falsely accusing them of election interference in Georgia. And that was, I think, $145 million. So defamation, I think, is something that can help. Now, as we said, not always perfect. You have to know who your defamer was and, you know, right, to be able to prove that. But I think it can be a powerful disincentive.
And those two women suffered greatly, yep, after Giuliani lied about them. So I think I want to turn to some questions from the audience. We have quite a few. Here's one that's a man named Joel says, it is said that we can't argue people out of a position with facts if they didn't argue themselves into that position with facts. But facts are ultimately all journalists have to work with in this environment. How can we improve the effectiveness of fact and logic-based debate?
Oh, that is such a great question. Because I do believe that a big part of this problem is that people are not looking at facts. People are looking at emotion, at identity, and that is why they are so easily manipulated by some of the things that we hear out of the mouth of, you know, Donald Trump and others. How do we reach those people? I think one of the techniques that I've tried to do, and I will confess to all of you, my mother voted for Donald Trump in 2016. We have since had several long talks about that, and she's come around to realizing that he is not who she thought he was. I think she thought he was the wealthy businessman she saw on The Apprentice, that he was somebody who knew a lot about business and he had fresh ideas and he would fix things. And I think she's realized that's not quite right. You know, one of the things I tell people is that when I go to court, I can't just make stuff up. I can't just appeal to emotion. I have to rely on evidence and exhibits. I have to show a document, an object, or an eyewitness before I can say that's a fact and we should draw a conclusion from that fact. And so when people say things that, you know, I believe the election is stolen, I think it's important to ask, you know, what do you base that on? And I think it's really important that we approach people from a position of respect and kindness and tolerance, which is not always easy to do, you know, when your mother is telling you that she voted for the man who fired you from the job you loved. It can be very difficult to do that with grace and with respect. But I think it's important to do that. And so I often just try to, you know, they'll say, well, I heard it on Fox News. Okay. And what were the facts that was based on? And you'll hear so often something like, well, I don't know, but it was all, I heard the whole thing, and you'll have to hear the whole thing because it was very convincing. Well, you know, were there any facts there? I describe a little monologue in my book by Tucker Carlson, who made an art form of just asking questions. He never used any facts. He would just say, ask yourself, why is it the media wants you to believe this? Why is it they're saying this thing? Why? And there's really no there at all. He just throws out a bunch of questions. He was sued for defamation and ultimately prevailed because even his own lawyers said he's not a news announcer. He's an entertainer. And he is just offering opinion and asking questions. He is not reporting the news, which I thought was very insightful. So I come back to this idea of asking people to ask themselves, what facts do you base your conclusions on? And I also think that don't expect someone to admit to you on the spot that they've been become convinced. You know, this was like a technique I learned in negotiating plea agreements and settlements. Like, you might not resolve it in the first meeting. It might take several meetings. And so don't expect the person to say, you know what, you've absolutely convinced me. How could I have been so wrong? Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's the end. Just give them some food for thought, right? Some things to think about. So, you know, maybe just ask, what do you base that on? What's your evidence? You know, what do you think about that? Because if you browbeat somebody, they're just going to get defensive and dig in. And so, you know, it may be they won't admit it to you, but they're going to walk away and they're going to start thinking about it. Start thinking, yeah, what evidence am I basing that on after all? And, you know, maybe the next time you talk to them again, you know, you try to get a little deeper and a little deeper. So they may never admit it to you, but even if you've caused them to ask themselves some questions, that could be helpful.
So here's another question from a man named Stuart regarding Fox. The question is, if federal communication has no jurisdiction over it because it is a cable channel, right, why couldn't the Federal Trade Commission force Fox to abandon the word news in its name as false advertising?
Hey, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good idea. I don't know. It is one of the challenges that they are not subject to federal regulation under the FCC because cable, unlike broadcast, is not a scarce bandwidth. And so they don't have to have these licenses the way the FCC does it. But I agree with you. It's not the case that they are therefore completely off limits from any government regulation whatsoever. You know, just as you said, truth in advertising, to call themselves Fox News when instead they're Fox propaganda. Maybe we could, maybe you're onto something there. I don't know the answer to it, but I think it's a very good idea.
It's a question from a man named Scott who asked, What sort of things do you think more specifically could be done in K-12 regarding civic education and media literacy? And I also have to intervene here and say that a former colleague of mine at the LA Times, Alan Miller, started several years ago a terrific media literacy program, and I hope it gets larger.
Yes. And in fact, you know, because I've been doing a number of these talks, I've been hearing from a number of people who have literacy programs that they are trying to grow. Media companies are interested in media literacy, and legal organizations, bar associations that have civics education as part of their mission. I was with another group that had a civics education mission. Maybe it was League of Women Voters. So I think this is something that is getting a lot of support. And there's a school, an effort, I think, in Pennsylvania. I don't know if we have any Pennsylvanians on board, where there is an effort afoot to actually make this part of their statewide curriculum, literacy. You know, I think it's going to depend on each state. I think it might even depend on each school district. You know, I know from time to time in my prior work at the U.S. Attorney's Office, we would sometimes want to work with schools to deliver some sort of message about public safety or internet safety or something along those lines. And although some embraced us, others would say, we are just so jammed with standardized testing and preparing for the test and other things that we already have to do. We just don't have any extra room in our curriculum for anything new without taking something else away. And so that can be a real obstacle, I think, to getting it done. But I think that offering civics education and media literacy education is a really great thing. So for school children, for sure. But I also think adults need it as well. And so, but there are a lot of places where adults can be reached. Public libraries are great, and they have all kinds of learning programs. YMCAs, organizations like this one have great learning opportunities. Faith communities, I find, have lots of great learning opportunities, and you know, civic organizations like Rotary Clubs and those kinds of groups. So I think providing media literacy for all these groups is a really great idea, and I'm seeing some good products on it. The publisher of my book, Seven Stories Press, actually has a very good children's book out called The Media and Me. I think it's aimed at middle schoolers, so it's not real young children, but it's like pre-high school too. And it talks about some of these techniques of disinformation and how you can spot them that I think is really good.
Let's go back for a second. We've got a question here about abolishing Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And one of the counterarguments that's been made, I was wondering how you could address this, is that if companies lose their, lose their, what they have is basically blanket immunity, that then they will just become overly cautious. And a lot of things that perhaps should be on the air, you know, that they'll just shut things down. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that it's probably not prudent to completely eliminate Section 230 immunity. This is the part of the law that says social media platforms are immune from liability for any content that is placed on them. So if you are Twitter or Facebook and Henry writes something defamatory about me on one of those platforms, I can sue Henry, but I can't sue Facebook and I can't sue Twitter because they're just providing the infrastructure. They're not, you know, reading the stuff. It's all, you know, whatever Henry put, and that's the sole basis for it. And so right now there's immunity, and some say that should just be gone and that I should be able to sue Facebook and Twitter as well. But the argument that I think was Stuart had is the one that is valid, I think, which is there's so much content on there. I mean, millions, if not billions of messages are flying around there all day, every day. They can detect some of it with their, electronically with their algorithms. They actually have some humans who, you know, check those things that get flagged, or when there's a complaint, they may look and take it down. But, you know, by and large, it's impossible for them to police everything that's there. So I agree with that. That's why I think that some modest rollbacks from that immunity would be more appropriate. To quote Bill Clinton, I would say, mend it, don't end it. Remember, it was this phrase about, I don't know what it was, affirmative action or something. Mend it, don't end it. And that's why I think that, as I mentioned earlier, some of the things where I would remove that immunity from legal liability are those areas like the regulation of algorithms, perhaps the removal of bots, requiring verification, so no anonymity, prohibiting the scraping of our data. And so the penalty for refusing to do those things could be civil liability, but that's different from, you know, policing the content that's on the airwaves. And so I think if we think about it a little bit differently, I think that there are some solutions there. You know, this is a classic all or nothing argument. This is another debater's trick. It's all, you either have to take it all away or keep it all. And in fact, there's plenty of room for compromise here, right? And so you restrict some of this immunity. Right. You don't have to roll all of it back. And, you know, the tech companies like to say, we can police ourselves. If you do this, it'll ruin us. Well, what if we did just, you know, a few of these things? I think they're all worth thinking about.
So we're getting near the end, and I want to go back to something that you said near the conclusion of the book, which is that this is a problem that should engage all of us, and that no one else is going to do it for us. It's not going to happen by itself, and that people need to do something. And perhaps most importantly is that you said something I think that's very important in this context, which is where you say to love America is to love the truth. And that is the antithesis of what your book is, you know, is addressing. I mean, or that it, you know, that you're fighting against. And I think people should keep that in mind. That obviously there can be legislative solutions, and some instances might be lawsuit. But I think all of us have some obligation in our everyday lives to try and deal with all the falsehoods that are hampering the country. So I would like to thank you very much for joining this evening. Thank you again very much for joining us, Barbara.
Thank you, Henry. Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure to be with you.